Miami loses its civilian police oversight. Governor DeSantis loses his bid to remake state parks. And Cuba's private sector again loses its battle with the communist regime. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the end of Miami's police civilian investigative panel, which a new state law has made illegal. We'll look at what might replace it and why Miamians hope to keep it. We'll also ask why Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suddenly ditched plans to turn state parks into what critics called commercial resorts. And we'll examine Cuba's tough new crackdown on private entrepreneurs and a supposed exodus of communist regime officials to Florida. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. 23 years ago, Miami voters overwhelmingly approved the creation of civilian oversight of the city's police. In 2002, the Civilian Investigative Panel, or CIP, was created. And more than two decades, the 13-member Independent Police Oversight Board reviewed citizen complaints of police misconduct and excessive force. By most accounts, it was an effective body. One of its most recent investigations involved a notoriously violent and racist Miami cop named Javier Ortiz, who was fired in 2022. But because of a new state law that prohibits municipally funded police watchdogs like these, Miami CIP will shut down at the end of September. It's another controversial example of state preemption of local government. But the question now is, what, if anything, will replace the CIP and the independent oversight role it played? The Miami Police Department says it's creating a new police oversight board that complies with the new state law and will work with the department's existing community advisory panel. But what do you think Miami should do now as the police civilian investigative panel comes to an end, as it appears is the case? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio here to review the CIP and preview what might come next is the Oversight Panel's Executive Director, Rodney Jacobs, Jr. Also here with us is WLRN's Government Accountability Reporter, Joshua Ceballos. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Tim.
Mr. Jacobs, let me start with you because I want to clarify for people, Miami is not the only city in Florida that is potentially losing a civilian police oversight body as a result of this new state law, correct?
That's correct.
How many other cities do you think might be affected by this?
You know, the numbers kind of shift here and there depending on who you ask, but anywhere between 15 to 20 municipalities, county governments have oversight of some form.
Mm-hmm. Is Miami sort of the one that, though, that people around the state look to as sort of the model?
I like to think so. Granted, here I'm biased.
Sure,
I will say that, you know, we are definitely an organization that has had some staying power, like you mentioned, over 20 years. But also we're well-funded and well-staffed, and we do a lot of great reporting and obviously look at systemic trends.
Why did the Florida legislature, Mr. Jacobs, effectively ban this kind of local civilian scrutiny of police forces? I mean, the state claims that it has an ample oversight and investigative set of instruments to hold police in Florida accountable, and that local civilian oversight like this is unnecessary, if not intrusive. What's your response to the state's reasoning here?
Well, I think obviously their reasoning is a little bit misinformed. I think initially their position was that they wanted some level of uniformity of police oversight practices and how they conduct their work throughout the state. And, you know, I could look at that and say, okay, well, fair enough. Let's see what can be done.
I had that question too, but why would we need uniformity here if, you know, if we're dealing with separate jurisdictions? It's not as if Miami City Police are going to be enforcing the law up in Hialeah or Fort Lauderdale.
Well, listen, Tim, that was exactly my retort right there. Yeah. It was that, hey, listen, policing is local, right? So what we do here at the city of Miami is going to be far different than what happens in Duval County, because policing is really localized to the populace in which they're serving. So mm-hmm. it made sense that some of our practices and policies differ depending on the population we were serving. So at least here at the city of Miami, at its civilian investigative panel, looking at how we did our work over the course of 20 years even changed as our culture changed, as our police department changed. And to yeah. in my opinion, that's fair.
Oh, Josh Ceballos, remind us why Miami voters back in 2001 resoundingly, I think the 76% of voters, resoundingly approved the creation of the CIP. Had there been, for example, a raft of police abuses at that time that galvanized this? What drove this back then?
Interesting that you say raft. So you might be familiar, around this time was the Elian Gonzalez controversy in Miami.
And I remember it all too well.
Right, exactly. And so there were a lot of allegations of police abuses, excessive force around protests about the Elian Gonzalez controversy.
I remember the tear gas that I myself ingested.
Exactly. Yes. And so I think that environment sort of created a need and a want in the community to, you know, overwhelmingly approve mm-hmm. more civilian oversight of police.
But we, even before then, we had also had
there was the McDuffie riots.
The McDuffie
in
riots. 1980s. So there was longer than just the Elian Gonzalez.
That was the immediate precedent. But I think just in general, over the decades, Miami mm-hmm. and Miami-Dade County has had a lot of these situations that have been flashpoints for police.
And was the notion of independent government-funded civilian oversight a relatively new one at that time, Josh? I mean, was Miami in a vanguard of sorts?
Well, no, I think civilian oversight boards have existed for a number of decades. I believe the first one was created in Kansas City, Missouri in 1959. But it definitely, it's caught steam more and more over the years, to the point where now it's more of a common thing. And Miami was one of the early ones within that era, mm-hmm. and it's certainly one of the most, like we were saying, well-known and effective ones.
And just quickly, how are its members? As I mentioned, there's 13 members mm-hmm. on the civilian investigative panel here in Miami. How are its members appointed?
Well, I can toss that question to Rodney.
Yeah,
I think
okay, sure. Not a problem. So they're appointed through a process, through our ordinance. We have what we call the nominating committee, and the nominating mm-hmm. committee are essentially a committee of panel members that are currently on the board that sit and take in applications from the community of people who elect to serve on the board. At that point, we conduct interviews, and then the nominating committee picks a slate of individuals to be appointed. Those people then go up to the City of Miami Commission, and then the commissioners approve it. Think of it as similar to the process of advice and consent for the United States Senate. Mm-hmm. The nominating committee has a slate that they vetted through an interview process, and then the commission then approves those individuals to sit on the board.
And well, Mr. Jacobs, since then, over the past 22 years, what would you point to as the civilian investigation panel's most important cases and accomplishments? I mentioned earlier the case of Javier Ortiz, who was actually a Miami police captain, correct? Mm-hmm. But what other instances stand out for you over these past 22 years?
There has been a host, and obviously I've been serving here as our assistant director and now director for almost 8 years. And one of the things I always look, or two of the things I always look towards is, one, our practices and procedures, systemic effects trends. We were at the forefront of helping roll out the body worn camera program and then doing a report on looking at how that body worn camera program was working or not working so well, from mm-hmm. Not utilizing them effectively or muting improperly. And then secondarily, and most recently as well, looking at our off-duty and extra-duty program, where officers may have been abusing that program, or even business owners not utilizing the process effectively. More recently, we've also instituted our community police mediation program, which was really the first of its kind in the state of Florida, that I like to call community policing on steroids, because it allowed people to discuss really difficult conversations.
But why does a body like the CIP, in your opinion, turn out to be a more effective tool for holding police accountable than, let's say, the conventional Department of Internal Affairs that we so often see on TV police dramas? You mentioned larger effects like the body cam usage for police, but why is a civilian civilian oversight more effective than the traditional internal
review? Well, I would say because of the independence and transparency. I mean, if you look at any police report from the Kerner Report to 21st Century Policing, one of the most pervasive things that are said there is policing culture and how that can kind of get on you if you are in and of the department. I think what makes us more effective is that we're an independent organization. We're run by city staff and employees, and we allow people access to us, whether you are a police officer or an individual member of the community. If you have a grievance against the police department, you can come into our office and file a complaint. So not only are we independent and transparent, people trust us. And having that level of trust from community members and their belief that we will do our work fairly and impartially is really what gives us our power and influence, in my opinion.
And if I can add also, I mean, there are times when it's members of the Internal Affairs Department themselves who need to be investigated because they have allegations against them. And so how can you, I think people maybe have a perception is, how can the cops investigate the cops?
Absolutely.
You know?
That's a good point. We have Michael on the line from Fort Lauderdale, formerly with the Broward Police Department Community Board. Michael, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on all of this?
Thank you. Actually, I was the chair for the Broward County Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. So I just want to co-sign what my counterparts in Miami have been saying. You know, this civilian oversight is extremely important because of the independence. We cannot trust the police to investigate themselves. And as a matter of fact, I had to remind members of my board several times that the reason that our community pushed for this, why Black Lives Matter and Dream Defenders and CJP and all these groups came together to push for this legislation, this ordinance, to be passed, was because the community did not have trust in the police department. You know, we have over 30 municipalities here in Broward County. About 20 of them have their own police departments plus BSO. BSO is one of the largest sheriff's offices in the entire nation. You know, they have a $4 or $5 billion budget, and there is very little oversight. These are public agencies taking public dollars and then trying to operate in private, in secret. Mm-hmm. And now they're getting help from the state government. And it's just been very disappointing that we haven't seen more pushback on this, but very few people are afraid to go against the governor right now. So,
well, no, I cannot say enough
that we need more people to get involved.
Thank you very much for that insight, Michael. And Michael, in this particular context, I think we should ask you your last name, so people, since you were formerly with the Broward Oversight Board there.
Oh, Howson, H-O-W-S-O-N.
Okay, great. Thanks very much again for your input. We really appreciate it. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Rodney Jacobs, Jr., who directs Miami's Police Civilian Investigative Panel, and WLRN's Joshua Ceballos about the closure, or the imminent closure, of the Independent Police Oversight Board due to a new state law banning it. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mr. Jacobs, I want to turn now to the what's next question. Just to recap for people, Miami's Independent Civilian Police Oversight Body, the Civilian Investigative Panel, or CIP, is slated to be shut down at the end of September because of a new state law that now prohibits cities from funding panels like it. You have pointed out, Mr. Jacobs, that the new state law speaks only, however, to civilian oversight resulting from city ordinances, but that Miami's CIP is written into the city's charter. Do you feel that's a real loophole through which Miami could actually keep the CIP going and still not run afoul of state law? And I know you've mentioned that you've made some legal moves recently toward that end.
Yeah, listen, I think that's absolutely the case. And I wouldn't even call it a loophole. I think the law was written this way in Tallahassee specifically to allow charter entities to still exist. I think when you look at the law that's come out of Tallahassee, the original format of it did include charters and any other laws. And then the final version was passed and it was just ordinances, in large part because the state didn't want to wholly preempt whole rule provisions by municipalities. So I do think that there's some ample wiggle room here. And so for us, it it only turns us to litigation for a multitude of factors outside of the state law. As you can probably notice, and this is something that I want to impress upon everyone that's followed this story and has been covering it, that this is a choice, this is a choice, this is a choice of the city of Miami to dissolve us. It is not required by the state for them to do so. And in the way that they're doing it, by removing our budget.
And when we say dissolving the CIP, we're talking about cutting off its funding.
Correct, yeah. By cutting off its funding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the law doesn't require that at all. This has been a choice by the city to do so underneath the guise of the state law.
So you still feel, in a legal context, there is a chance that the CIP could survive beyond this supposed end of September dissolution date?
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, granted, we're going to have to make our arguments to the judge, and the judge is going to have to make a determination, but I think we have pretty good ground to stand on.
Josh Ceballos, meanwhile, the Miami Police Department says it is in the process of creating a new police oversight board that it says will be in compliance with the new state law. Tell us more about what they're fashioning over there.
The state law allows for sheriffs or police chiefs to create their own oversight boards that have that are formed by appointees of the police chief or sheriff.
Okay.
So that's kind of what the Miami police chief Manny Morales is doing right now. But, you know, as we were saying before, I think some people have a perception that, can the police properly investigate the police? And so I think there's a lot of questions there. And I just want to put a point on this, that the CIP, a big part of what the CIP did and has done is, although they can't directly do discipline, they can give recommendations, but that's public and transparent. So journalists can read their reports and say, hey, this is a case that was closed by Internal Affairs Miami Police. This is a big deal. It needs to have attention. And then those cases get reopened.
Right. We need to clarify, cases like Javier Ortiz, he is not fired by the CIP. It's just the CIP presents the evidence to the department and says, look, this is a bad apple, and
presents it to the department and to the public. And for journalists being able to pick up on that can bring more light to that and then cause more groundswell for these issues.
Now, the department also promises that this new oversight panel will work closely with its already existing Community Advisory Panel, or CAP. But Josh, is that a body that's as independent and equipped as the Civilian Investigative Panel is to monitor police, hold them accountable?
I mean, again, these are positions that are appointed by the police chief or the police department.
Yeah.
So I think there are some questions there.
Okay, not as much then as what we had with the CIP. Mr. Jacobs, I want to finish things here by going back to that to this question of what effect you fear the loss of civilian oversight of the police in Miami will have on the city and the community, not just in terms of monitoring police, but also in terms of the relationship between the police and the citizenry, if this were to happen. Yeah.
Listen, I always go back to this. It's all about what we call procedural justice, which boils down to trust. You know, last time I checked, there's not a lot of people that commit crimes in front of cops. So in order for cops to do their job effectively, they have to have a good relationship with the community members to gather evidence, to get information, to uphold public safety. It's going to be increasingly harder to do that when the public does not trust you. If anything that the CIP has done over the last 20 years, our crown jewel, is that we help bolster trust in the community so that police officers can do their job effectively, but then also use our department, whether you be a police officer that has a grievance against the police department or an individual community member that has a grievance, to come file a complaint in our office. Understanding that they are a part of a city, of an organization that is fair, it is the strongest component to help build resilient and sustainable cities. And without that, we don't have the mechanism necessary to grow and be effective.
Well, let me ask you, how do you feel Miami police officers themselves feel about the possible disappearance of a civilian independent oversight board that's been watching them now for 22 years? Do you feel that they are disappointed or relieved?
Listen,
to see it happen.
I'd imagine it's a love-hate relationship to an extent. As one caller has said earlier, or maybe even Joss had mentioned, to do this kind of work, to be the disinfectant, to be the light in these places, it's sometimes a lonely battle. And I think over the course of almost a decade of work here, I've had multiple police officers come into our office and utilize our services where they felt it was necessary, or to engage in mediations where a meeting of minds was had when they said, hey, I could be better, I can be trained better, I can get new practices and procedures in the work that I do. So for me, I really think it's a component of our society, of our culture here in Miami, getting better through this idea of community. And without that trust, we really don't have much to turn to.
And Josh, finally, in about the 30 seconds we have left, from your journalist perspective, what's your sense as to how deeply people in the city of Miami will miss this oversight board?
I think they will. Like Rodney was saying, they need something that they can trust. And I think people who have a grievance with a police officer who maybe treated them wrongly, they might not want to go to the police department to report it. And they'd like an independent office that they can do so. So I think that it will be missed.
Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Rodney Jacobs Jr. is the executive director of Miami's Civilian Investigative Panel overseeing police conduct. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Last week, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection sent out a press release that created a firestorm. It detailed plans to seemingly make over several Florida state parks with stuff we usually associate with Disney resorts: golf courses, frisbee golf, tourist hotels, and, wait for it, pickleball courts. Public backlash was swift and angry, especially because the Environmental Protection Department said it would not take any questions at public meetings on the matter. But the outcry wasn't just from hikers and tree huggers. Even the state's conservative Republicans blasted the proposal and urged Governor Ron DeSantis to pull the plug on it, which DeSantis did this week, though not before blaming a, quote, left-wing group for leaking the plan to stir controversy. South Florida parks would have been affected by the makeover, including Dr. Von D. Mizell-Eula Johnson State Park, a Broward site that has deep emotional historical significance for the Black community. How do you feel about what may now be the aborted plan to give our state parks a more commercial facelift, as it were? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to hash this out is WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich. Also here is WLRN's Broward County reporter, Carlton Gillespie. How are you guys doing?
Good, Tim.
Good.
Jenny, if it's even possible, recap for us how this whole drama blew up last week and this week, starting with that Department of Environmental Protection press release.
Right. So on Monday, the department posted a press release on its website and tweeted out plans under the Great Outdoor Initiative that said this is something that was started last year where they cut admission prices for entrance to the state parks. But this year they were expanding it to include golf, yeah, pickleball, lodging, cabins at 9 state parks.
Okay.
And then the next day, a memo leaked out, written by somebody on the staff, or it was instructions to the staff that when they held the public meetings, there were going to be pre-taped presentations, and the staff was not to take any questions, just receive comments from the public.
Uh-huh.
This blew up. There were details in this leaked memo about the proposals, including the sort of most controversial, which is the golf courses at Jonathan Dickinson State Park.
What were the origins of this idea? I mean, we know, for example, that a veterans organization in Oklahoma, right, was somehow involved in the plans for golf courses in the state parks. But what brought about this whole idea of a makeover of this kind for Florida state's parks?
So at the press conference this week, Governor DeSantis confirmed that he met with this vets group, Folds of Honor,
right,
on April 10th, and they approached him. They pitched the idea of doing golf courses. He said the idea of putting golf courses at Jonathan Dickinson was appealing because there was an old military base there,
okay,
from World War II. There's still some derelict buildings. This would provide, if it succeeded, you know, low cost greens fees, make it more accessible to families to play golf, which is often expensive. But then somehow, and I'm not sure how, that then rippled out into pickleball courts, frisbee courses, lodging, the hotels at 2 state parks that, you know, one of them and near St. Augustine would be the largest hotel in St. John's County.
And so why then was the public blowback, I mean, even as I mentioned, from fellow Republicans, so fierce? Let's listen to one of the protests you covered here in Miami-Dade County this week and the voices of the kids who have a stake here.
It's just going to be another place of a city, and we don't want that to happen.
If they destroy their home, the turtles are going to be sad and they don't have anything to eat.
Orlando is the place where nature gave this to us.
When I lost my brother, the first thing I did was go to a park. When it was his year anniversary, what did I do? I went to a state park. I know that so many of us heal here.
The turtles are going to be sad. I wouldn't want to be the politician who has to answer that. The Miami Herald's editorial yesterday, though, I think summed it up well in the sense that most people agree that state parks, especially in Florida, and here's the editorial saying, quote, they exist to protect our last slices of wilderness, and that, quote, pickleball and disc golf are a better fit for municipal and county parks. But does that really explain the visceral reaction that we saw to this?
Well, getting state parks and conserving land in Florida has been a hard-fought battle over decades. We used to have a program, we still do, called Florida Forever, mm-hmm. under Governor Rick Scott. Funding for that was gutted. I mean, it is very hard to get state parks created. I talked to Eric Draper, the former parks director. He said that when he was the parks director, there was 175 state parks. There's still 175 state parks. The yeah. need continues to increase. Bill Bagg State Park, yeah. Top Sail, or there's the park over in Honeymoon Beach in mm-hmm. Tampa. Sorry, that's the other side of the state for me. Are, you know, just packed. Bill Bagg's shuts down at 10 o'clock mm-hmm. on the weekends.
That's my favorite beach.
Yeah.
Carlton, as I mentioned, at least two state parks here in South Florida were on the roster for this makeover. One is Olita's River State Park here in Miami-Dade County, where pickleball courts and tourist lodging cabins were proposed. Another is the Dr. Von D. Misselula Johnson State Park in Broward County, which turned out to be an especially sensitive site, especially because of the history of the beach there. Tell us why.
Right. So that beach, back in the 50s, the county purchased that land on the barrier island, and it was designated as the colored beach during segregation. It was the only place where mm-hmm. black people could go to the beach.
Right.
It wasn't easy to get there.
In Broward County.
In Broward right. County, yeah. that's mm-hmm. right. And they said people would come from as far north as Boca and as far south as North Miami-Dade County. But, you know, it wasn't easy to get there. They had to take a ferry across, or as someone I interviewed this week said, he had a four-wheel drive, so he was able to drive up the sand to get there. But mm-hmm. It was really kind of a sacred place
right.
where they could go. And
more
so,
than just a state park. I want to play a clip here from your interview with 77-year-old Earl Benneby, who stresses that parks like this do have particular profiles that need to be appreciated.
We're not refusing any upgrades or anything they would do to contribute to making it a better beach. You know, we welcome those changes and stuff, but let's make it better. But let's not change the culture.
And that was echoed by Emmanuel George, a Broward community archivist who runs the Instagram account Black Broward that chronicles the county's black history.
We need more emphasis on preservation, on the history, to educate people more on this beach and the stories that led to why it is the way that it is right now.
Jenny, do you feel as though people felt much the same way about other state parks down here, like the Olita State Park in Miami-Dade, that this park makeover plan was going to harm not just the natural character, but the cultural and historical character of these places? I mean, I get back to the point the woman made earlier in your protest reporting, that folks here have come to see state parks almost as a spiritual retreat in some ways, no?
Right. And, you know, in a state where wildlands and undeveloped lands just keeps getting gobbled up and there's less and less of it, people really, really treasure these spaces where they can see undisturbed Florida. It is very hard to find pieces of Florida that are left in their natural state. When I was at the protest, not just that woman, but other parents say they like bringing their kids to places where there isn't anything to do, where yeah. what they have to do is like climb a tree, dig in the
right.
sand. You yeah. know, they don't, they want them to make their own fun.
That's a great point. We have Thomas on the line from Hollywood. Tom, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on all of this?
I appreciate what everybody said about this. The value of these places from a historical perspective, a natural perspective, and outdoors perspective. But, you know, the way that this was going on, I hate to sound so cynical, but I was wondering who's going to benefit from this or profit from these hotels and picketball courts, golf courses, and whatnot. And who's going to build these things? Who's going to operate these? Who are they going to be run for the benefit of? I heard on the show before about, you know, the Folds of Honor and Tuskegee Duns or something like that. And to me, it sounded like just a way of selling to the public.
Yeah.
So I don't have to, you know, I'll take my response.
No. I mean, no, thanks for bringing up that point, Thomas. We really appreciate it. And presumably these are questions that would not have been answered at the public meetings about this. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Jedi Stoletovich and Carlton Gillespie about the controversy over Florida's now aborted, it seems, plan to make over our state parks, including sites in South Florida with golf courses and pickleball courts. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Carlton, how could state officials have gotten this so wrong? And did the fact that they said they weren't going to take questions at the public meetings about this plan seem to suggest that they knew that this might not be all that popular?
Well, it's kind of hard to think about how they could have gotten this so wrong, obviously in hindsight with the massive blowback. But as Jenny mentioned, the governor had met with the head of one of these organizations that was going to do a development in here. Is it because they weren't listening to the public in the first place? Did they just take their impetus from a developer? You know, that all hasn't come out yet, but there is indications that this plan was a lot farther along than DeSantis said when he called it half-baked and he had never seen or heard
about. Yeah, Jenny,
I
want to pick up where we just left off there with Carlton about the huge political miscalculation of this whole plan, and that includes Governor Ron DeSantis. He didn't exactly come off as a profile in courage over all this when he tried to make it sound as though he really didn't know anything about it beforehand, and especially when he blamed all the uproar on some unidentified, quote, leftist group that supposedly leaked the plans. I don't mean to sound cliche here, but what did the governor know, and when did he know it?
Well, like I said, in that press conference, he confirmed that he met with them on Folds of Honor on April 10th. But then he also tried to distance himself from this by saying it was half-baked, I didn't know about it, I didn't approve of it. It could be that he knew about Folds of Honor or this idea for bringing golf, but not the pickleball hotels, other things they could have. But Eric Draper, who I mentioned before, is the former head of the Park Service, said that when plans go to the top, like the State Parks Department under the Florida Department of Environmental Protection doesn't do anything on its own. Those plans are fairly vetted before they get rolled out. And in this instance, meetings were already planned. There was documentation. There were lists of proposals. There were maps. There were schematics.
All right. This was further along than the governor makes out. Carlton, though, how do you think the state could have handled this better? What, for example, are some palatable ways they could improve the state park experience in Florida without turning it into Disney World? I mean, we just mentioned Bill Bagg's Cape Florida State Park on Key Biscayne earlier. I love the historical lighthouse on the beach, and I'll admit I also love having the cafe there for lunch or a beer. What's the right mix of natural preservation and commercial amenities if they're going to try to upgrade these parks? Because I'm pretty sure they're going to come back with plans like this in the future.
Yeah, well, and I think Earl sums it up well, and we played the clip earlier where he says we're not against improvements. There are improvements that need to be made at these parks, whether it's, you know, maintenance or installations like that. Earl specifically mentioned a band shell because he remembers, you know, going to the beach when it was segregated and hearing concerts and music,
right?
And maybe that's a way to kind of culturally enrich this. It's about having a context-sensitive design, though.
Yeah.
Doing something that makes sense for the community, where you don't have a public meeting, where you're not taking questions, you have a public meeting where you're going to incorporate, you know, public suggestions and do something that people want, because there are improvements that can be made. But I think you said it best. Don't make it Disney World.
Yeah. Jenny, let me ask you the same question here as we finish up. What's the balance that needs to be struck here as we move forward? Because as I said, it seems to me some new version of this plan will probably rear its head again in the future. No?
Right. So I talked to a land use attorney who used to be the general counsel for the South Florida Water Management District. He says there has to be a nexus between the amenities and the cultural resources or environmental resources you're trying to protect. So like a band shell, would fit in with that. Mm-hmm. If it's a beach, you know, some kind of trail. And to go back to Thomas's question about, you know, these amenities, they're often found in national and state parks.
Yes.
It's mm-hmm. one way that they make money. They have concessions. There's a kayak concession, a paddleboard concession at Olita, and part of that money goes to help maintain the park. But again, the amenities have to enhance, highlight, promote the resources that the park was created to protect.
And again, as the public was saying this past week, if you want to pursue this, consult us.
Yes.
Yeah. Jenny Stiletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Cuba's private entrepreneurs are widely considered the only cohort that exercises any appreciable independence from the island's repressive communist regime. That's a big reason the Biden administration has taken new measures in recent years to promote the Cuban private sector's growth. At the same time, Cuba's epic economic collapse is a big reason the regime itself says it wants to promote private business, or at least has said. But the sad reality is that its old and entrenched Marxist leaders just can't allow that to happen, which is why last week those party patriarchs once again issued new rules that handcuff the private sector and further smother its growth, this time while fairly ludicrously blaming Cuba's capitalists for all the country's, quote, economic distortions. But here's the kicker. At the same time, we're hearing about a growing number of Cuban regime officials who are gaming the U.S. visa system so they can, shall we say, retire from the workers' paradise and come live here in the dastardly American imperio. Do you perhaps have a relative who's trying to run a private enterprise in Cuba? Are you aware of any Cuban officials coming to live in La Florida? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to offer some perspective on these Cuba developments is Miami attorney Ricardo Herrero, who today is executive director of the nonprofit Cuba Study Group in Washington, D.C. Always great to talk with you, Rick.
Great being with you, Tim.
Rick, you and the Cuba Study Group, which I should remind our audience promotes engagement between the U.S. and Cuba as a way of forging change on the island, you issued a pretty strong statement against the new measures the communist regime just announced that heaps even more restrictions on private entrepreneurs there. Can you remind us what these new measures are and what the regime says the rationale is for imposing them?
So the regime announced a new package of laws that were meant to be an update to the current legal framework that governs the private sector, and particularly those new entities in the private sector that were first legalized just 3 years ago, which are small and medium-sized enterprises. So the equivalent in the United States to an LLC.
Known as PMEs in the vernacular.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So under the rubric of correcting distortions in the economy and attacking tax evasion in what they are calling a wartime economy.
Right.
They announced these new laws that basically changed the rules of the game for this private sector in Cuba. And some of the more damaging new obstacles that are brought about in these new laws are, for example, the fact that now, up until today, really, because the laws won't go into effect till mid-September, but till right now, anybody in Cuba can import a container worth of goods,
right?
As long as they go through a state import export agency, to whom they have to pay a nominal fee, they can import all sorts of goods.
I should mention, Rick, that in the past few years, the importation of those goods done by the private sector in Cuba has now even surpassed the importation that the Cuban state is accountable for.
For household goods,
right?
Correct. Not for all imports, but okay. Certainly for household goods. Now, what many of those entrepreneurs were doing is that they were importing goods and then selling them in the wholesale market to other entrepreneurs in the market. So I would bring in goods.
Right.
Let's say I brought in containers of chicken, and I would sell some in my stores or in my restaurant. But then I would also sell chicken to other stores, other restaurants, right? And so I was operating in the wholesale sector. Everybody was doing this. And now the new rules impose strict limits on who can import and sell in the wholesale market. Now, your primary social objective, your objeto social as a business in Cuba, in order to be able to sell in that wholesale market, whatever you import, has to be as a wholesaler. And there's no telling how many entrepreneurs will be authorized by the government to work that function. But that means that everybody else that was limited who was bringing in goods because it was more cost efficient to bring in the goods that you need, but also more goods to fill up the whole container that then you can sell in the market, you can no longer do that.
And
can only bring in what you need and you can't sell anything else. And that's a huge constraint.
And on the on-the-street effect of this is that Cuban consumers go out and find less chicken, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's expected, this is also coming in the heels of new price controls on some staple items such as chicken that were already causing entrepreneurs to reduce their orders or flat out stop them until they had a better sense of where all this new framework was going.
Yeah.
So already we are seeing what we're hearing on the island is that there is a dwindling inventory of chicken in the country.
Yeah.
That is going to remain low for the next few months because there's no real sense for how these new laws are going to be enforced. And the fear is that now the chicken that is there or that will trickle in will just spike in value.
Right.
So already very expensive chicken is going to be incredibly expensive.
And we can assume that this will be the case with other, necessary items that Cubans need. Your Cuba study statement also makes the very salient point, as you made, that just 3 years ago, the regime legalized private businesses in Cuba, largely because they realized they'd have to promote the private sector if the country was ever going to escape its economic collapse. And it seemed in these past 3 years that private entrepreneurs were getting a freer hand. I mean, just last summer, my colleagues and I were all writing about the Cuban capitalist boom. Did it seem to you also that things were just heading in this direction in terms of expanding the private sector?
It was far from perfect. I mean, the law that allows for the formation of these PYMEs, these LLCs, had many shortcomings. There were still many restrictions. They couldn't accept foreign investment.
Right.
They didn't have
informally they were getting foreign investment from many sources here and around the world. No,
informally they were getting in the form of remittances or arrangements between you and your relatives or your friends abroad. They also didn't have access to a formal currency market where they can buy hard foreign currency, say dollars or euros, so that they can pay those foreign suppliers. Mm-hmm. They were having to access that currency in the black market or through informal swaps with partners in other countries. So there was still a lot of inefficiency in the space. And what we were hoping is that as you saw the state recognize the value of the sector more and more, they would open up greater space, open up a foreign exchange market for these actors, and also finally authorize their ability to accept foreign direct investment in a formal way.
So
now what we see is that it seems that in that whole process, the military and the entities under their military-run conglomerate that manage a lot of foreign capital flows into the country, particularly hard currency, begun to feel threatened.
Okay.
They saw their market share threatened because they were no longer controlling the flow of foreign currency into the market. And they're heavily sanctioned. They're in arrears with all their suppliers around the world. And they saw that if they didn't try to rein in this private sector, they could lose control. They could their own state-owned enterprises, much of them are under that umbrella. Could also
and that loss of economic control, as far as they're concerned, leads to the slippery slope of losing political control. No,
exactly, which is the ultimate fear. You know, they all see the case of the Soviet Union, and the fear of that ever happening is what puts the brakes on so many things, and also spurs so many of these counter reform waves that we see in Cuba.
Right. But so, Rick, what can the Biden administration do, if anything, to counter this? It just allowed Cuba's private entrepreneurs to open bank accounts in the U.S. But the Cuban regime and the private entrepreneurs themselves say what they really need is direct bilateral correspondent banking between the U.S. and Cuba, which the U.S.'s economic embargo against Cuba just doesn't allow. What's the answer to this on the U.S.'s end?
Well, the U.S. could authorize correspondent banking. That's something the Cubans also need to authorize on their end.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that so much of this is driven by the military and them wanting to open up currency flows back into their coffers and that of the many entities that they manage gives a certain degree of leverage now to the United States that they didn't have before, because it actually changes the nature of many things like state sponsors of terror or lifting other sanctions on medical programs, et cetera, because mm-hmm. these are all activities that bring in hard foreign currency into the private sector. If you lift Cuba from state sponsors of terror, European tourists no longer risk losing their visa waivers to the United States. They can pour into state-owned hotels, and that goes into the coffers of the military.
Right.
So I think what the opportunity here for the Biden administration is to push the Cubans to the table. It's no longer easing any further sanctions. There's not much more that they can do at this point.
Yeah.
That because what's left is codified under law.
Yeah.
But force them to the table and say, listen, this can't go on. Mm-hmm. This can, you know, you cannot, if you want us to have some sort of trade relationship, it cannot be in these terms.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Cuba Study Group Director Ricardo Herrero about Cuban officials' new crackdown on private entrepreneurs and whether or not a growing number of those officials are at the same time coming to live here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Rick, I want to turn to that growing concern here about Cuban regime officials, in particular those who've been identified as committing human rights abuses there in the past, making their way to live here in the U.S., even in Florida and Miami. This issue came to the forefront again earlier this month when a former top Cuban Communist Party official named Manuel Menendez Castellanos was spotted arriving at Miami International Airport. Is this something, Rick, the Biden administration needs to be watching more closely, or is it a case of Cuban exile hardliners perhaps exaggerating an issue for political purposes?
Clearly something in the process is broken, because this was not a goal of this parole program. Certainly it was to ease the pressure off this raging exodus that we're seeing out of Cuba.
Right. Do we know for sure that Menendez Castellanos was coming in through this new humanitarian parole program?
Well, I'm not clear, to be honest, whether it's through the parole program or the family reunification program. But
right.
either of these, because there's multiple programs, right?
Right.
Either of these programs were not designed to help make it easier for former secretaries or former generals of the Cuban military or secretaries of the party or people who are responsible for repression to give them a pathway into the United States, right? We mm-hmm. know that is not the purpose of these programs. It's also, you have to consider the fact that we are now looking at a third straight year of over 200,000 Cubans being reaching U.S. borders.
Right.
It's this raging...
I think more than a million in just the past few years, no?
Yes. Well, yes, in several years. But in the last 3 years, it's been over 600. We're approaching 600,000,
right.
which to compare it to something that South Florida folks are familiar with, that's the equivalent of almost five Mariels in the span of 3 years.
Right.
Mariel boat lifts, mm-hmm. right? It's just a staggering number. So you have all those cases that are being processed at the border. You have the cases that are being processed through these different parole programs and family reunification program. It's foreseeable that some folks will slip through the cracks, but obviously these are cracks. This is not part of, this frustrates the purpose of these programs. It should be fixed. And so that mm-hmm. when consular officers, whoever's reviewing these applications,
yeah,
should look into the background of some of these individuals.
No, that's a good point.
Make sure that they were not in one of these roles before.
Rick, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there for time. Ricardo Herrero is the executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington, D.C. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup.
Welcome to the panel!
The 2024 Paralympic Games kicked off this week in Paris, And we want to give a shout out to the three athletes with South Florida ties competing there. From Fort Lauderdale, Abbas Karimi is swimming for the U.S. as a top butterfly competitor. He was born in Afghanistan without arms, and he was part of the crew that won the U.S. medley relay at the 2022 World Para Swimming Championships. This is Karimi's second Paralympics. Christy Raleigh Crossley, another swimmer for Team USA, went to Pinecrest High School in Fort Lauderdale. She is paralyzed on the left side of her body, but yesterday she broke the women's 50-meter freestyle world record. University of Miami graduate Lee Fredette was paralyzed in a dirt bike accident. He's competing in wheelchair rugby for the U.S., which yesterday won its first match, defeating Canada. I watched some of the wheelchair rugby. It's amazing. The Paralympics will run through September 8th. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the conversation or others from our show, you can always catch up by searching for the South Florida Roundup podcast each week in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.